I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1983. The album is The Meaning of Life soundtrack, the artist Monty Python, and my guest is Traceable U via Skype. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you, Jason. I'm looking forward to this.
So it's been a while since we've done a Monty Python album, but I realized I had never actually heard this album, despite knowing most of the songs by heart.
Yeah, you know, I went back and listened to it recently, and I thought it was just all the songs, but there's quite a few sketches.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some original material, you know, to link the stuff together to make it kind of cohesive for a different, you know, obviously a different product.
Sure.
But it was... you know, I collected all of these Python albums when they were out. I've lost many of them,
of course,
which I'm very upset about. My favorite was Striped Tie and Matching Handkerchief.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
And if your listeners know what a vinyl album looks like, I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
But Striped Tie and Matching Handkerchief had both sides of the album on one side of the album.
It had
two grooves.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was maddening because they didn't really tell you, and you would put the needle down and you would be, wait, I haven't heard this. And then where's that thing? And it was so cool because they were really playing with the medium. Plus it was a really cool album. It was, you know, that was back when, you know, people were doing interesting like cutouts and things with, album sleeves and all of that art. So, the Meaning of Life was a real treat to listen to again because it's I don't know how many songs you have to have in a movie to classify as a musical.
Right. Yeah. Good question.
Because this really is a musical. It's a musical comedy.
It is, and these songs are the ones that I grew up listening to on, actually I think on Monty Python Sings, which is a great collection, and if you don't know Monty Python, it's actually a good way to get into them.
Yes, I've got that one, and then there's also Monty Python The Final Rip-Off.
Yes, brilliant.
Which I actually have that on album as well. But yeah, Monty Python Sings is... I listened to that over and over and over while we were doing Mystery Science Theater.
Really?
And there is an episode where Crow actually says, I think we're singing a song to Sandy Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And our lyric was, sit on his chest and watch him die. And you can hear Crow say, sit on my face. Because I had been listening to the Python album.
Of course. Oh my God. That's amazing. I have to make sure that this is very self-promoting of me, so I apologize, but there's one of my favorite episodes of this podcast. It was also via Skype, so you're in good company. Andre Jackman, who produced all the Python albums.
Oh, really?
He did an episode, and he talks about not just the interesting packaging that came out, but some of the insane shit they tried to do and didn't get to do.
Oh, really? Like what?
My favorite one, the one that stands out the most, is he just said, yeah, and then there was the exploding album we tried to make, and I said, what are you talking about? He said, you would open it, it would basically pop open, and you'd never be able to put it back together. And I thought that was, but he said it was too thick, too cost prohibitive, and I was like, oh my God, but I want this. If there's a prototype, I desperately want to see this.
I had not heard about that.
Yeah,
that's
no,
beautiful.
I don't know that anybody had. I'd like to think we found about it first on my podcast. Probably not. What's your experience with Monty Python? So did you buy this before you'd seen the film Sight Unseen?
No, I saw the movie and of course loved it. And I'd been collecting their albums. You know, I was a huge fan of the show, as you know, so many people were. And then I just needed more.
Yeah.
And, you know, started buying up the albums I had. Life of Brian, I also lost that one. That's a terrific soundtrack. I'm surprised this still plays on my record player because I've worn it out.
Hello, this is Terry Gilliam welcoming you to Side 2. Of course, you won't be seeing my animations on this being a record. My normal contribution is, of course, mainly visual. And one of the things I'm most proud and happy to have contributed to the film is an opening sequence about Pirate Clark. Now, this began years ago when I was really quite a young man, about 45, 46. I remember coming home from our weekly...
It's fun to charter an accountant and sail the wide accountancy to find, explore the funds offshore and skirt the shoals of bankruptcy. It can be manly in insurance. We'll up your premiums semi-annually. It's all tax deductible, but very incorruptible. We're sailing on the wide accountancy.
You try to take care of your LPs and keep them in the sleeve. And, hey, don't take the wrapper off.
Right.
Don't take that plastic off, man. And then there's always a roommate or an ex-girlfriend or something that goes, hey, this should come off here.
Oh, no.
But I, you know, the movie was first, and then, you know, I'm obsessive when I find an artist that I like. I got to buy everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got into Talking Heads and I went, oh, okay, I got to go backwards and forwards in the catalog to get that. And then Tom Waits was the same thing. I went backwards and forwards. And then Zappa absolutely killed me because he just keeps making stuff.
Yeah.
You go crazy trying to collect every single item in his catalog. But I tried to do it with Python.
Mm-hmm.
And then strayed off into other stuff like the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm still looking for, you know, comedy albums. I love, I think that's probably my favorite thing is the comedy album.
Is it a matter of every time you get one, you have to be a completionist, or are there certain groups that you're a completionist with?
I think I might have tried to give up on being a completionist.
Okay.
Because there's so many versions, and but I still hunt down like Firesign Theater, or I did find some old, Bob Newhart,
uh-huh.
his early albums, and the Smothers Brothers. And I had all of those from, you know, you find them in bargain bins.
Sure.
And you find them for a buck and, you know, they're not that good condition. And again, I've lost all my Smothers Brothers.
Oh,
I gave
no.
those to somebody to listen to and I never got them back.
Oh, no. I can tell you, I have doubles, triples, quadruples of some of them if you need any. I have overbought.
That's a good thing to do because then you've got your set to lend.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, I'm sitting here staring at a pile of, I think, 30 that I either didn't realize I already had or just thought, well, maybe this is slightly better than mine. And, you know, if it's in a pile where they're each 20 or 50 cents each, like they are at my shop nearby, I just say, screw it. And, you know, flood the apartment with albums.
Oh, yeah. What shop? You're in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Yep. I live in Burbank. So the one shop we have nearby is Atomic Records, and it is phenomenal. It's phenomenal. It's a great shop for being small. What's great is nobody cares about the comedy section. So I won't say I'm the only one buying the stuff out of it, but it is, that's kind of the joy of collecting, is that it's rare that anybody else is there looking at it at the same time.
That's pretty cool. And there's, I met a guy in Minneapolis who produces new comedy albums.
Mm-hmm.
Dana Gould was in town at the Acme doing a show. And, you know, I was talking to him afterwards and he goes, what are these? What are these big things? So they are still being made, which I'm thrilled to see.
One of our We like to call him a sponsor because he's helped us out with equipment here and there. Dan Schlissel is based out of Minneapolis. He owns Stand Up Records. I don't know if that's the company that you saw, but
it might be. But there's quite a few people in Minneapolis doing it.
That's so great. Such a good town for comedy, which is one of those things growing up where you don't know that unless people tell you about it. It's a hidden secret growing up.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely. Are you from LA?
I'm from upstate New York originally. And I'm the butt whose best man lives in Minneapolis and has never visited and desperately wants to, because the comedy is just going to kill me. I know it's, and I'm very excited, but I've never made my way out.
Well, Acme is probably one of the best clubs in the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's run so well. Lewis Lee is the proprietor, and he's so good at training his audiences to, you know, and his comics. He's nurtured so many people coming up that you're going to go see a great show.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to have to go through all the hash and you know, people in training.
Right.
So I can't say enough about that club. It's fantastic.
It is a dream of mine to do a podcast from Minneapolis. So one of these days it will happen. So I apologize for not knowing. So are you lifelong Minnesota?
Well, I grew up here, and in the 80s during the comedy boom, when anybody could get a job doing stand up,
mm-hmm.
I did stand up. And then Mystery Science Theater hit in the late 80s, and that sort of satisfied my performing Jones. And then in 96, I think I moved to Los Angeles, and mm-hmm. I was out there for 11 years. And I was lonesome for lakes and rivers and trees.
I get that.
So moved back to Minnesota, and now I live in the woods.
What was your stand-up act like?
It was utter crap. I had started doing improv with a group in the early 80s at a little club, and loved it. I love collaborating with people. I like working with a group,
mm-hmm.
And I loved doing improv. And then the comedy boom hit, and everyone kind of scattered and went, hey, we can all, make money.
Yeah.
Not a lot, but so that sort of left me in a place where I didn't that wasn't where I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
But since all these rooms were hungry for somebody to stand up in front of people, I did it and got to meet a lot of really cool people, like Dana Gould. Went on the road with him through the Dakotas,
mm-hmm.
30 some odd years ago, and met some really cool people, and really loved hanging out in those clubs with that kind of energy. You mm-hmm. know, there's that community of really, really talented people. But yeah, once Mystery Science Theater hit, I never looked back. But now Frank Conniff and I are doing a live movie riffing show around the country.
Right.
And it's like doing stand-up. And it's like doing improv. And we've got the movie as like a third partner.
Yeah.
In our little comedy troupe. So back on the road and loving it. Having such a great time meeting audiences all over the country. And so it's kind of come full circle.
When you first heard, okay, so you saw Meaning of Life in theaters, and then you grabbed yourself the album and wore it out. Did you share it with anybody, or was this just your thing? Was this just for you?
It was just for me. You know, a lot of my friends loved the Pythons, but it wasn't like we'd get together and watch them or listen to the albums. This was,
right.
I think the first thing I did was probably put it on a cassette tape
mm-hmm.
and listen to it in the car,
yeah.
you know, all the time. As, and then, you know, as I think I replaced I probably have the CD around here someplace too. Mm-hmm. I probably could have listened to it on that. And it's, you know, how many iPods, right? That's mm-hmm. what they were, iPods.
Uh-huh.
how many of those ago did I load this into that system?
Right.
But yeah, I love the Pythons. I love that they, you know, they could have just done a soundtrack album, had somebody throw that together.
Yes.
And walk away. Mm-hmm. But they actually put some work into it to make it a standalone product.
And I was actually very excited because, you know, there, if obviously some of their albums, when they recreate their own sketches, some of them are actually, I actually like the audio versions of their sketches better. But in this case, they are, it also has to be with a product. So it has, but they had, they, there's so many of the sketches from a very visually brilliant film that work so well as audio. I was shocked.
Yeah, I was too. That's a really great point. They have the sex education class sketch, and that's, and I don't know if it's because I have the visuals in my head.
I was thinking that too, right?
Anytime. But that works really well. The all of them do. The war where they're giving the sergeant all the clocks.
The Meaning of Life, Part 4. Fighting each other.
Okay,
Flackett,
Sparrows and Walters, you take the buggers from left flank. Horton, Spudger and I will go to the gun post.
Oh, hang on, 6-8, yeah. You'll never make it, sir. Let us come with you.
Do it, old man.
Right, lads, get up. Sir. We don't meet again, sir. I'd just like to say it's been a real privilege fighting alongside you, sir.
Yes, well, this is hardly time or place for a goodbye speech, eh?
No, me and the lads realise that, sir, but, well, we may never meet again, sir, so...
Yes, all right, Blackett. Thanks.
No, just a moment, sir. You see, me and the lads, we've had a little whip around, sir. We brought you this, sir.
Well, I don't know what to say. It's a lovely thought. So thank you all. I think we better get to the cover now.
Hang on a tick, sir. We got something else for you as well, sir. Sorry, it's another clock, sir. There was a bit of a mix-up. Walters thought he was buying a present, and Spadger and I had already got the other
Eric
one.
Eric Idle, his character, gets his leg bit off by what he thinks is a mosquito. just really, really brilliant stuff. But they, you know, it does play well. It plays like radio.
Yeah. In a very, and I think in terms of even the sound, you can hear the budget a little more because mm-hmm. much as I love their first films, which I absolutely do, this one's more lush. So I feel like there's a lot more sound design. I could be wrong. I'd have to go back and re-listen to those films without watching them, but it does feel more lush than the other films a bit.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. And I don't know if it's the, what is it called? The fidelity mm-hmm. of an LP, that you get more nourishment that way. But I noticed that when I was listening, and I'm glad you brought that up because I was like, wow, this is really more intense than I remember.
Mm-hmm.
More satisfying audio-wise.
Yeah, absolutely. And that maybe that's why I like it so much as well, because it reminds me of some of their better produced stuff. I think maybe Final Ripoff was the stuff that I listened to the most in terms of their sketches, their recreations and stuff. And those mm-hmm. are just so detailed. The sound design's amazing.
Yeah. There's a documentary where they interview a lot of celebrities, and Steve Martin is interviewed, and he said initially he thought the Pythons were an album act.
Right,
that they were just doing comedy albums, and they could have just been that. They
Absolutely.
Could have been like Fireside Theater, which is also one of my favorites to collect. Looking for this Python album, and I went, "Hey, I still have. I think we're all bozos on this bus. I still have that. All Hail Marx and Lenin. I still have that one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they've." Oh, I don't know how many different versions of Fire Sign I have, recording them off the radio.
Yeah.
I also found all my National Lampoon Radio Hour tapes on cassette.
Uh-huh.
Record, and this was like there was no equipment to record off the radio for a guy like me. So you'd have to put the recorder up to the radio. It's like, there must have been a better way to do it, but I didn't have the equipment.
Right. What, you know, that's something that I missed out on growing up, where I did and when I did. There was no comedy radio. Maybe once or twice they'd play a shitty novelty song, but I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the opportunity to. I wouldn't have discovered Firesign Theater if it wasn't for my best friend's records. And when he played them for me, I was 13, didn't know what the fuck I was listening to, so I didn't get it. So what's your experience with comedy on radio? Like, when's the first time you heard it, if you can remember it?
Oh, the first stuff had to have been Firesign Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother had been recording it off the radio. And then we had these tapes that were really cherished because mm-hmm. they were so funny. But that was Firesign. It would come on late at night, like on a Sunday. And it would be, I think, King Biscuit Flower Hour and then some comedy show.
Mm-hmm.
And they would play Bob and Ray and,
awesome.
You know, all kinds of stuff like that. The other collection that I was just listening to that on an airplane the other day. But yeah, it was, I think it was National Lampoon came after that. And that's like mid-70s,
mm-hmm.
somewhere in there. National Lampoon Radio Hour, which was a half hour.
Okay.
Which was a pretty cool thing to do. Cause they'd come on and go, look, some of our affiliates are not playing the full hour of the National Lampoon Radio Hour. So please call them and tell them you want the full. And it wasn't an hour. It was a half hour. So that same kind of messing with the audience.
Oh, that's so good.
Like the Pythons were doing.
Yeah.
And I've got all of those tapes. I've got all of those cassettes. And then I bought the boxed set of CDs of the best of the National Lampoon Radio Hour. And it doesn't have all the stuff I've got on cassette. So I was pleased that I've kept those.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder if there is, I mean, I'm assuming there's not a purchasable archive of that, but it's great when people have those things in their hands because sometimes... archivists I've seen, because a good friend of mine is a Firesign Theater's archivist, and sometimes you have to turn to the fans because that stuff's valuable, very valuable.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've got early recordings or off-air recordings of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Really?
Which is a little bit different than, you know, the LP versions.
Interesting.
Yes, I have gone and played them side by side. That's how obsessive that I've gotten.
That's so good.
But yeah, I'm a huge fan of audio comedy.
Yeah. Have you produced any or been in any yourself?
No.
That's shocking to me.
You'd think I'd remember. No, that's
very weird to me.
It's weird to me now too. Now that you bring it up, what the hell is wrong with people?
Well, I'm not going to commit you to it, but I'm working on a comedy album, and you're welcome to be in it if you like.
Oh, I'd love to. I'm a huge fan of old time radio.
Yeah,
And listen to that pretty consistently. And we did a radio show in Chicago about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, where we did a stage reading of an old Johnny Dollar episode. He wasn't a detective, he was an insurance investigator, which I find fascinating.
It's amazing.
The man with the action-packed expense account. So the chapters were always introduced with expense account, 439 taxi to the airport. And it's like, oh, okay, that's a cool way of doing it.
Uh-huh.
But we did this, you know, complete stage presentation with sound effects and director and music and all this stuff. And it was so much fun.
That's great.
But I would love to do something like that.
It's
again,
it's very pure, and you get to use that part of your brain where if you know what you're doing, where you realize, oh, wait, am I actually communicating what I thought I was communicating? Because I'm so used to getting to wave my hands around or whatever you do when you act. I mean, I don't tend to walk around with my hands waving around. But, you know, you do think of it in a different way. And it's, I think, I mean, that's one of the joys of listening to it as well. The good stuff where the acting really comes through.
Yeah. One of my favorite things to listen to is early Dragnet episodes on the radio.
Really?
Because the sound design is just, I'm fascinated. Because, you know, they're just walking down a hallway and they're just talking. It's like, oh, what's going on, Joe? Oh, nothing much. How was your weekend? Oh, pretty good. Mowed the lawn, did this stuff. And all the way through this, you hear their feet on the floor.
That's great.
The foley of them walking down the hallway.
That's amazing.
And you can almost tell what kind of shoes they're wearing. It's it's just so much fun.
You know, and that's, I mean, at least for me, those are the comedy albums that go to that kind of depth, which is, I mean, you're naming all the ones that do that. Do you have this is a rare one, oh, not a rare one, but it's one of their, I guess, maybe nobody's ever brought up the Meaning of Life soundtrack before. Nobody's ever asked to do it. Do you have any of their, like, more traditional sketch albums? Like, if you were to pick one of those?
Well, yeah, like, I've got The Final Ripoff. Mm-hmm. And you know, like I said, I've lost so many.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
I absolutely would kill myself, and it would be justifiable homicide, justifiable suicide, I think, for losing striped tie and matching handkerchief.
Yeah.
And I've got some on CD, but it's just not the same. You know, there's a commitment you make when you put an album on to listen to, and. I'm so happy that I've saved all these and collected new ones. Just the art alone on these things is so amazing to me.
What is that? Since I don't have it, do you have it with you, or do you not have this one? I'm sorry.
Which one?
The
Meaning of Life.
Meaning of Life. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big tombstone with. A lightning bolt coming down that has carved the letters in the tombstone.
Right.
And then there's neon Monty Pythons above the tombstone. And then there's what looks like a sticker, but it's printed on the album that says the only soundtrack album to be introduced by Live Fish. And then in parentheses, apart from some copies of Shane.
So ridiculous.
And then the liner notes, it's printed in such a way that if you flip the album over and read the back cover, the album falls out of the jacket. Because they didn't put it together, you know, like a, you know, oh, I'm going to put this on the shelf. And, so I had to be very careful.
Just those little simple things that just take advantage of your audience and just also make them risk. Like I said, they wanted to do an exploding album. So these are the kind of guys who don't really care about. They love the album experience, but they'd also would like to ruin it, which I appreciate it.
No, it carries the experience to, you know, the end user, which I appreciate. That's why I still love to collect these things because, you know, it's like here I'm looking at. All Hail Marx and Lenin, which is one of those albums that spreads out. mm-hmm. and you've got the entire Nick Danger Private Eye, you know, photos of that story. I was so disappointed. Well, I was thrilled and disappointed when CDs came out because it was easier to access them.
Sure.
But then you lost the art and the fun of an album and, cleaning your weed on a double album, which I guess the kids don't need to do that anymore because they just go down to their dispensary.
Uh-huh.
And it comes in a little bottle. And so, they don't need to be cleaning that on an album anymore.
I always forget that album is actually a gatefold because that's the one thing I regret about having to frame it. Because I'm slowly but surely making Phil Proctor sign every album I have. Because we're doing one album at a time with him, just having him talk about what he remembers of the making of these. And mm-hmm. I force him to sign them every time. Have you ever gotten to meet any of the Pythons? That's something I always want to know.
I've got a couple of friends that are good friends with those guys. Howard Johnson, or Kim Howard Johnson, is one of their biographers and has been, writing books on them for years.
Oh, sure.
And years.
Yeah, okay.
The life before and after Monty Python and the first 280 years of Python.
Uh-huh.
It's actually then the zeros crossed out, so it's 28 years. I met John Cleese through Howard. And had dinner with John and a few other people up in Santa Barbara.
Oh my God!
Really nice guy. Just an absolutely thrilling. I'm just a thrill to meet him, and he was very just cordial and gracious, and everything you would want in a celebrity encounter. And we have dinner, and we finish dinner, and he goes, "Should we have dessert, or should I order cheese?" And he begins to order cheese, and I don't think he was being funny or uh-huh. ironic, but he was reading the cheese sketch, and it was like, oh my God!
That's amazing.
And I've met Terry Gilliam.
Mm-hmm.
I met Terry Jones briefly at Dragon Con,
mm-hmm.
And he directed Frank and I in a little sketch of a segment of Life of... Holy Grail,
mm-hmm.
which was a thrill.
That's amazing.
And then we, the year previous, we had dinner with Terry Gilliam at Dragon Con.
Wow.
And the coolest thing was just to hang out and just shoot the breeze and go, here's a world-class director. Hello.
Uh-huh.
Here's a guy that's influenced my comedic sensibilities since I was in high school. Hello. And we're just talking about illustrators and, he raises bees and I raise bees. And it's like, hey, we're just a couple of guys talking. It wasn't like, well, yes, I've made some amazing motion pictures. It wasn't like that at all. Just a regular guy and just so nice and, easy to talk to and be around. A Minnesota guy. He's from Minnesota.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay. I always forget that. I mean, I remember that he's American only because his accent sounds like one of the Pythons trying to do an American accent because he's been there so long.
I know.
The hard R's and everything that seems so uncomfortable coming out of his mouth, but that's just his voice. That's just how he speaks.
Right, right. He plays the American in the yes. Grim Reaper sketch.
That was my first thought. Yeah,
that's exactly what he sounds like.
Oh, that's so good. It's one of my favorite things ever. Is listening to the other Pythons though try to do American. They don't care, obviously, but I love that they're probably doing their best. But it's as I would sound to them doing an English accent, and it's a delight.
I think they heighten that a little bit and really kind of dig in on some of those very American-y kind of American-y like that kind of words, and phrasing and hitting the accents and consonants and all that stuff. Because you hear like actors, British actors who are legitimately trying to do an American accent and they just come off sounding like you know, they're in a Python sketch.
Yeah. Yep. I from what I understand, Doctor Strange might have been that way. I don't know. I didn't see it. And I love Benedict Cumberbatch, but I don't know that I'd be shocked.
Yeah, I didn't quite go for his accent. Uh-huh. And there was really no need for it. He could have been a British guy.
Right. Just rewrite that just a little bit. It's
yeah, and it would have been fine, but he's doing that kind of... You know what he sounded like is Hans Gruber when he you know, he encounters...
No.
Yes, exactly.
Bill Clay.
Yes, Bill Clay. That's the first thing I thought of when I heard Cumberbatch do the American accent.
Well,
and
now
I have to see it
just for that. I have to see it just for that.
Oh, I couldn't get that out of my head, and that's all I could hear. Oh, you're one of them.
I am death.
Well, that's cast rather a gloom over the evening, hasn't it?
Don't see it that way, Jeff. Let me tell you what I think we're dealing with here. A potentially positive learning experience that can...
Shut up! Shut up, you American. You always talk, you Americans. You talk and you talk and you say, let me tell you something, and I just want to say this. Well, you're dead now, so shut up.
Dead?
Dead.
All of us?
All of you.
Now, look here. You barge in here quite uninvited, break glasses, and then announce quite casually that we're all dead. Well, I would remind you that you're a guest in this house.
Be quiet. Englishman, you're all so fucking pompous. None of you have got any balls.
Can I ask you a question?
What?
How can we all have died at the same time?
The seven moose.
There was a What are the safe houses or whatever they are for those guys? There was one in New York. There was one in London. He could have been, you know, out of that office.
That's true, yeah. I mean, there are aliens in this universe. It's not unfeasible that somebody could be English.
Well, all the people in the Star Wars universe are English.
That's true. That's a very good point. It used to all be the baddies, but now, you know, we've got at least one good guy who's English. Also Obi-Wan. What am I thinking? But maybe he was a secret spy. Okay, I don't know where that came from.
Spoiler!
Yeah. I apologize. I got us off on a bit of a tear there, but... So, all right. So, let's go back a little bit to you first listening to this album. More about the experience for you. Were you a speakers guy or a headphones guy?
I was a speakers guy.
Uh-huh.
Because I didn't have any headphones that were worth a damn. I think my first pair was a pair of Koss folding headphones that I would use with my Walkman.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's right, kids. Back in the olden days. But I had my own room, so sound wasn't a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I could probably have picked up stuff a little bit more better, maybe like learning how to speak, had I been using headphones.
Were there other comedy albums in the house? Other than maybe what sounds like your brother might have had some, but mom and dad?
They didn't have any comedy albums. I think the first comedy album that hit our door... my sister came home from camp with all the Bill Cosby albums. You know, Why Is There Air and all of that stuff. And I think we did have the Smothers Brothers, at least one of them,
mm-hmm.
When I was a kid growing up. Cosby was the first thing that I remember that we had that we all gathered around to listen to. And memorize.
Yeah. Not atypical. That does seem to be the case. It's obviously harder to talk. That's why nobody brings it up. If hey, what albums do you want to listen to? They're like, that's the one that gets mumbled.
Yeah. Well, you know, before all of this happened, those were just extremely funny. Well, and they still are, I guess, if you can get away from some of the, you know, stuff from today, but
sure.
Those were the, and then I think we had it was Cosby and Smothers Brothers and Bob Newhart were the ones I remember kicking around the house. And then we moved into Firesign Theater, you know, more absurdist stuff.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I tend to gravitate towards more that stuff, Monty Python, National Lampoon.
Did you now, you know, the thing is, I find that sometimes there are people who are a little more in one camp or the other, but it sounds like it doesn't didn't matter to you. You're not necessarily. You don't necessarily prefer like a Firesign, which I think Firesign is the one that's, you know, for real comedy lovers. I mean, it's to the point where it took me a long time to understand what I was listening to. So, it you know, I feel like that's kind of when you graduate a little bit. Did it take you a while to get, where'd you first, I mean, you heard them on the radio, but what about it was attracting a pretty young kid to listening to more of it? It is insane.
I think it was the first, like, really quoted comedy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't around for, like, when The First Family was a popular,
sure.
was, like, the number one album.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the Firesign stuff was, like, I guess, you know, it was transferred from mouth to mouth. It was so viral, you know, before there was viral. I would hear the routines before I heard the albums because they were getting passed around mm-hmm. like Python was.
Yeah.
You know, you go, what are you talking about? And you go, oh, it's the show Python. And you go, okay.
Uh-huh.
Although I knew Python before any of that. And then it wasn't cool to be those guys that would just spout Python stuff all the time.
Sure.
But that's how Firesign was, injected into my life was just my brother's friends and he were doing these quotes from Nick Danger,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's like, well, I got to know what that is.
Yeah.
And he had them on cassette tapes and they were intermingled with lectures from the University of Minnesota from history and sociology lectures that he had. So sometimes I didn't really know I wasn't listening to the comedy.
That's fantastic. Wow. You know, I've never heard anybody say that that's how they discovered Firesign. I've never heard of it in the sort of word-of-mouth way before. This is the first time I've heard people talk about it in that way. Normally, it feels like you... I don't know. I've never gotten a succinct story about it. So it's actually good to hear that that is one of the ways that Firesign spread to some of their fans.
Yeah, I don't know how other people discovered it other than... You know, hey, I just found this album and you got to come over and listen to it.
Sure.
But we got it through the radio and I guess I got it secondhand from my brother and these, you know, I might be wrong. I might not like Firesign Theater. Maybe I just liked these history lectures that he was listening to.
There's part of me that wants you to have those tapes and record them and just release. I'll give them to their archivist and just tell, listen, I need you to release this as a new Firesign thing. See if anybody notices. That's amazing. That's so good. Now, as far as was Mystery Science Theater your first experience getting to turn stuff into sketch? I mean, was that your first sketch experience beyond...
Well, we did some stage stuff with this improv.
Oh yes, I'm sorry you mentioned that, right?
Company, and then, but really formally, yeah, that was when we really started churning out material because we had to do 5 sketches every episode.
Right.
So it was a great, and they were all short, which is, I think, it was good training
mm-hmm.
to be concise and short and. You know, like the Pythons had a way of just ending a sketch. We had Movie Sign that could always get us out of the sketch
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Cut to the Mads or a commercial. I think it kept us efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And if the sketch wasn't very good, it would be over soon.
Right. you know, this is making me think of and I cannot remember because I did not get to grow up with Mystery Science Theater. I didn't get it until late in high school, which I, you know, I tell my wife that. She's like, you're a poser. I was watching that show when I was little. There is a sketch, and I cannot remember how early in the show it is, where it is a Bergman film that later becomes a Schlitz commercial. Was that an episode that you did?
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
I thought so, right?
Shot black and white.
Yes.
Can
I tell you, like, that is one of my favorite sketches of all time because I didn't know the reference, but it is so, the context is so perfectly given to you that I figured out that must have been a Schlitz advertising slogan. Like, it took me not that long, but I got to tell you, that is somehow designed so perfectly that, you know, I mean, that's, it's one of the underrated parts of MST3K, of course, is the sketches. But
well, and I, you know, that's really cool to hear, but I don't think anything was designed on that show. It was like, what can we do now? Mm-hmm. And let's have fun. Sort of the same experience I had with Python, mm-hmm. which I wouldn't necessarily know the context of what they were talking about,
mm-hmm.
Until much, much later. But it was funny. It was just funny the way it was performed, the way it was costumed, the way, you know, the characters were drawn out. And then later you find out, oh, that's actually means something.
Yes. Right.
That's referencing something else. Oh, okay. That's even funnier.
Yeah. Now that you have the internet, you can look up who Cyril Connolly is from the end of the Eric Mahaffey.
Exactly. Song. Yeah, exactly. We didn't have that when we were, and we got a lot of stuff wrong.
Sure.
You know, just relying on our memories and, you know, hey, we got to write this today. We don't mm-hmm. We can't go to the library. And people have called us out over the years for going, you know, you didn't get that right.
Oh, no.
And it's like, well,
is it that important?
Are you going to do?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of the joy of sharing these things. Sometimes it becomes a game of telephone, but in that game of telephone, you're still, you know, having a conversation. So it's there are worse things than getting a reference wrong. Sorry, yeah. Fellow nerds. I know that I'll be hung for that, but. Okay, so what I like to
It's 12 parsecs.
Right. So if you were going to recommend this album to somebody, let's assume somehow this person doesn't know Monty Python, or maybe they don't know the Python films. What's a good reason to listen to this album?
You will laugh. You will just start laughing. I think the way it's introduced, I think you'd get it. I think you could, if you didn't have the visuals, you would probably, it would be like a radio program. You would create them in your head.
Yeah.
And if I'm totally wrong, again, what are you going to do?
Right. That's perfect. I mean, you know, I ask that question every time, and I'm perfectly willing every time to accept that answer that it's funny. You know, that's absolutely fine. But I do like, you know, that little bit of examination towards the end sometimes reveals these little things that you think about, you know, or maybe you're thinking about the whole time. This episode is going to come out soon. When I say soon, I'm stalling because I need to look at the date that this is coming out. When I say soon, I mean apparently a month from now, unless it needs to come out earlier. So if you have something to promote, or several things to promote.
We are, The Mads Are Back, which you can find on Facebook, The Mads Are Back.
Mm-hmm.
We just call ourselves The Mads for short because mm-hmm. we get tired of talking about ourselves. We're going to be out on the road extensively in the next few months. So check our website, check our Facebook page, and find out where we will be coming to Austin, Texas, Washington, D.C., perhaps you've heard of it, Kansas City, Omaha, Pittsburgh, or in the Pittsburgh region, Dallas, and all points north and south. So check us out. We will be in a town near you at some point.
That is wonderful. I like that people still get the chance to see you guys do this stuff. I do hope you make your way out here sometime, although I understand that, you know, LA is not necessarily the easiest place to book or sell tickets at. necessarily.
I think the latter more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People are so busy. I could never go see anything while I was working in Los Angeles because sure. I was working.
Right, right. Well, that's a bonus. Well, thank you very, very, very much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. This has been a thrill, and I really like the whole concept of, you know, the comedy on vinyl. I think more people need to embrace the vinyl.
I think so. It's a lot of fun. It's just fun for me. I mean, that's why I have so many damn albums sitting here. Speaking of which, I'm going to promote something very quick because I'll still be doing it when this comes out. I am listening to a comedy album a day for all of 2017. If you're listening to this, I probably will have caught up. I'm only a couple days behind. And if you guys have suggestions, you can just email me, jason@comedyonvinyl.com. If I don't own it, I'll find a way to listen to it. But yeah, and I'm reviewing them on YouTube at about 7 minutes a tick, I suppose. And I actually did this one just the other day because I said, well, you know, I had to listen to it anyway, so that's mine for the mine for the day. So,
free.
Yeah, exactly right. So you guys should just check that out. That would be a lot of fun. Well, again, Trace, thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you, Jason. This has been a lot of fun.
You're obviously more than welcome back. I'd love to have you back either in person or by Skype again. You know, no pressure. I'm just going to keep putting the pressure on.
I'll pick out another album. I've got musical comedy. Does that work?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm looking at my my signed Martin Mull album here.
That is funny. We are about to do, I've got friends coming over right now. We're about to do I'm Everyone I Ever Loved.
That's the one I'm holding in my hand.
Really? Yeah. That's
one of my favorites.
That's the one James Urbaniak picked for our sixth anniversary show that we're going to record in about 5 minutes. So yeah.
Oh, well, say hello to James Urbaniak.
I will.
And tell him I've got a signed copy.
That's a little hard to, that's hard to beat. Thank you guys so much for listening. And as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.
A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.